we connect this at the listener to this one? No, sorry. I always get the dates wrong here, at least in some place. Don't worry. Okay, good morning. Last time we have started to think a little bit about how to control robots, how to make robots do what we want, and we will continue today essentially in the same lines. What could happen if we send a signal to a robot? So it's usually not only about to find the right way to talk to the robot, but also to consider that the robot will take time to react to our command, such that it's not just a function we have to deal with or we have to solve, but we really have to know about the time course, how the robot will react. And on the other hand, of course, a reaction may provoke a counter reaction, and so it could happen that the effect of the robot or the reaction, the correct reaction even of the robot, actually counteracts our interference with the robotic system. We will have a look on such possibilities, and maybe not too much this time, but next time we will talk about what can be done in such cases. So today we will only conclude with some ideas about general control principles and this feedback control, which is often most convenient in these cases, will be talked about in more detail next time. So we have been starting to discuss differential equations a little bit, some kind of dependencies of an is this good enough? Dependencies of the change of a certain function, of a certain robotic speed, of a position of the robot, of an angle of the robot, of any function of the state. So we have been discussing in particular this simple type of an equation, which here you can type in and every differential equation solver will be able to deal with it. You can even solve it by hand if you spend 2 minutes. The behavior looks like this, just to remind you. So wherever you start, independent on the single parameter of this equation, you can observe two different types of behavior. Either the system blows up, or if this parameter A is negative, then the system decays to zero. So that's maybe not all we would like to see in a robot, so it either maybe stops or tries to exceed the maximal speed, but it might give a good start because it tells already how we can regulate an quantity to a certain point. In this case, it's unfortunately only the zero where we can anything regulate to, but it's not too difficult to arrive at an equation where we can regulate the system to any point we like. And this will be discussed on this a little bit complex example. So some students might ask themselves whether you are required to know things like this. So if you look to the past papers, you will find out that you might be required. So maybe like 5 or 4 years ago, there were really exactly these types of equations in the exams. But I would like, if there is something related to this, I wouldn't like to do it in this kind of very mathematical and explicit way as it was at that time. But the strategy is what is important, and we will try to conclude maybe in a more quantitative way from this example how, for example, to regulate a real robot here. So here in this case, it's more an abstract vehicle which receives some voltage from its battery, and the output is the speed of this vehicle in the environment. So some operations happen here in between, and it might be a good idea in order to understand this relation between the battery strength, or maybe just the voltage input to the system, and its behavior by looking a little bit more into this black box here. So what we have is some kind of an example of standard electrodynamics, where every battery is, so to say, compensated, or the voltage from the battery is compensated by a resistance. So whatever happens in this black box, it will have some kind of resistance with respect to the voltage, such that some of the voltage is lost here by a current traversing this resistance. But there's also another interesting effect. So as soon as a motor, this electric motor, as soon as it starts to rotate, it will generate itself a voltage. So this voltage is dependent on the speed. So these electric motors, they have some kind of wiring moving inside the magnet, and if this rotor is really moving inside this magnet, then it creates also a voltage. Of course, it uses a part of the voltage in order to generate this movement, but on the other hand, it also produces voltage. So this voltage is not really very helpful. It's more a kind of resistance, actually, of the motor against the voltage, and this voltage is counteracting the voltage of the which is provided by the battery. But anyway, what we see here is that there is this kind of sharing of voltage, which can be really used, and which is some kind of a byproduct, but which has to be added to meet the battery voltage. In this way, only part of what you put in is really useful for the system in order to drive the vehicle. And of course, part of this is again maybe lost just by flowing of the current through the wires in the system. But there is also some kind of electrodynamic force which produces a voltage and which cannot be used in the system. On the other hand, this voltage doesn't really set the speed of the vehicle. What it can do is only to accelerate the motor, and this acceleration depends essentially on the torque which is created by this motor, and the torque is directly proportional to the current which is produced here in spite of these resistances to through the system. Such that if you look back to our earlier equation, we have now maybe a more complex equation, but it's in a sense more simple because it really connects those quantities which we are interested in. So on the one hand, we have still this battery voltage, and on the other hand, we have the vehicle speed, which we wanted to determine or maybe to set. It unfortunately occurs here once as in your plane speed, and on the other hand, as an acceleration, as a change of speed. There are a number of constants here which might really determine the behavior of the system, but we will not care about this for a moment, but maybe instead try to analyze first what kind of behavior could be suggested by such an quantity. So maybe we can also rewrite it just by concentrating on the variable which actually changes, which is a more classical way to represent differential equations. So here we have our quantity which changes, and here we have some other information. We have available some function which involves this quantity itself. So of course we can just choose a small time step, calculate this, and then during this time step we can just assume that S changes by this amount, so it can be can grow or maybe can even decrease, and so we can integrate or iterate this procedure, multiplying time step by change of the quantity for a long time, and so we get already at least numerically some kind of idea what happens. On the other hand, we can also solve this problem analytically. Again, our process equation, this was the voltage, and S is still the same S. So there is some way to solve this simply by reducing or transforming this to the same shape of a differential equation as we have been solving last time. I don't know whether it's really important to go into the detail. So maybe this is a differential equation which is possible to solve, but anything which is already slightly more complicated, you always would call a program like Mathematica or Maxima or something like this in order to find such a solution. So that it's maybe not really important to go through. But we should have a look at the solution which we get, which looks kind of similar in as the solution of this more simple equation. So we have also this kind of term here, an exponential, which can either decay or explode in dependence on these parameters here, and which is connected to some kind of starting value. So maybe the starting value can even be zeros, and we wouldn't have any of these ones. So this kind of prefactor A by B tells us if it's positive, then this effect of the starting position will go away, whatever it was. Yeah? On the other hand, there is a second term, which is now special to this equation, and which tells essentially that deviations from one here, or maybe one multiplied by some other parameters, deviations from a certain set value will also decay in this way, provided again that A by B is larger than zero here in this case, such that it seems to look quite promising in the sense that it could really stabilize a certain quantity. So the solution was somehow characterized essentially by this A by B, yeah, which often is considered to be a kind of time scale, so how long we have to wait here, how far t has to grow before we can see this effect that something has been forgotten or something has been reached. Also we can of course express this in the terms of the particular equation which we have been dealing with. This gives us some idea, but maybe it's a more basic idea which we could have already studied actually from the very beginning is, so if this voltage really has the effect of establishing a constant velocity at some point, you know, that the vehicle is really running with this particular speed which we have. It may take a while, but if this is happening, then we can be sure that this change of the velocity is actually zero. Yeah? Setting it zero, then of course the quantity, the equation becomes much more simple, and we know that voltage is simply proportional directly to the speed. Of course, we may have to wait for some time before this will really be established, but we can really extrapolate, so to say, at what value, at what speed value this motor will settle. So maybe we need to do it for a couple of different voltages in order to determine this constant, if this is not, for example, provided already by the manufacturer of the motor. So this is an important quantity. But this t is not less interesting because it tells us essentially how long it takes to arrive at this stationary level. So here in this example, the stationary level is just chosen to be 1. So this interesting time scale shows up here in the following form. So assume we are here, so in this case this would be 0, and we wonder how long it would take to reach the stationary state. Obviously we will reach it never ever because it will be just this kind of approach, but what we can say is that after a certain time, what we can ask, what is the time really it takes to maybe do half of the distance to the goal, and we can just take our solution here in this case. So maybe here if we start at 0, then we can forget about the first term again. We have only this one, and we ask when we arrive at half of the stationary value which was in front of here. So we have only to consider this particular factor here, which needs to be 1/2, or this one, needs to be 1/2. And this gives us again some kind of constant here. It depends really whether we ask for 1/2, then this exponential gives us here a logarithm. which typically can be approximated by 0.7, well, the logarithm of 1/2, or minus logarithm of 1/2 would be 0.7. And then there are some constants which corresponds to our A by B, or in terms of the physics of this quantity, resistance and mass, and these proportionality constants, it would look like this. So that's from the whatever is here in the exponent will determine our behavior. And this exponential decay of the distance to the final state is also as nice as this kind of half time really has the meaning. If I'm maybe at this point, if I have waited for one time step, then it takes again the same time exactly to make an approach again by a factor of by a factor of 0.5, so that each single time step I come closer to the goal state by a factor of 2, so to say, or the distance reduces by a factor of 2, simply as a consequence of the exponential function here. So in this way, this is a very important characteristic which tells, so to say, how fast I approach this goal state, even if it if it's not really reached at any time. Sorry.
So it's just basically then telling us if we apply an acceleration, how quickly or how the controller will get us from its initial state of velocity to the final state.
Yeah. So we will not reach the final state. It's just approaching. Yeah. But so in an exact way, it tells how long it takes to traverse half the distance bis to the, until you reach the final state. So you will not for the next half, so to say, you can only do 1/4 in the same time step, and you can do again another eighth in one time step, and so on. Yeah, so come closer and closer, and at some point this will not. There will be some kind of noise. You will not feel any difference anymore. So typically, after maybe 3 or 5 time steps, you assume that we are sufficiently close, and this time doesn't depend on because whatever we have here for a final state just cancels out. This time doesn't depend on what distance you actually have. So if you have if you are very far from the goal state, you can you will approach the faster and again in the same time manage to be twice as close, so to say, to the goal state as before. So this is a kind of interesting behavior. This is another quantitative example. So if we assume we know really the numerical values of our parameters here, then it's easy to express this dynamical equation of the system using these parameters. And we can, of course, calculate now as a final speed of the robot, or we can maybe also find what kind of how much time we need to come closer to this speed. Of course, now you can of course ask, so if the car has maybe twice the mass, then it would just take twice as long to really accelerate it to the same speed. But it would finally arrive at this speed if you have a good battery. So you can analyze also some other changes using these kind of solutions here. This is just to summarize what is important. So most of the interesting control problems can be expressed by an differential equation, such as, for example, this one. And what is interesting in many cases is how to set a certain goal state. If I want, for example, the temperature of a room to be more or less constant, or the speed of an hard drive to be constant, for example, things like this. So I want to set some kind of stationary behavior. And on the other hand, I would also like to know what to do in order to adjust this behavior. So if I set my behavior, then maybe I need to know what kind of voltage I have. And in addition to this, of course, it's good to know what is the sloppiness or the delay of the reaction of the system, which is expressed by these time scales. And if I take the full solution, then it tells me about what really happens all the way while I'm approaching this goal state. So maybe we have started already last time to talk about such a robotic application. So in a robot, of course, you might like to have a similar behavior. Yeah? If the robot has maybe some kind of distance from the wall and you want, or distance from maybe a desired trajectory, and you want the robot to move to this desired point, so how should the robot do this? Yeah? And there's always this kind of danger that it's overshooting. Yeah? So as soon as you just change the angle to with respect to maybe you want the robot to be in this distance from the wall, so the robot is slightly deviating from a straight line, which always can happen, and you measure that this distance has increased after one time step maybe. So what can you do? Either you could just control theta back to the desired or to the necessary theta value parallel to the wall, which wouldn't really solve the problem. Yeah, you would still stay at the larger distance. You could, of course, also overcompensate. Maybe so there is a distance here between these two angles, and you just correct by twice this distance. But then after two time steps, so to say, after two time steps having reacted, you would maybe just have the opposite problem, and the robot would be wiggling around all the time. And so maybe this example, which we have seen just previously, can give us a hint what to do in such a case. And one possible solution would be to be a little bit more proactive in a sense. Yeah? So you should not wait really until this error, the deviation of our measured distance from the wall and the desired distance from the wall has really reached a positive value. But as soon as it's increasing, yeah, then we should maybe act to this. So one way of acting to this is just to increase a little bit the speed of one of the wheels. So of course there are other actions you can take about this, but this might be a possibility, just to increase a little bit then. And so you are not really waiting before you are actually deviating from the wall, but as soon as you start to deviate, if this error is increasing, if the presently measured error is larger than the previously measured error, then of course you can already counteract. So maybe if the robot is still, so to say, facing towards the wall, yeah, but already maybe trying to move away, yeah, because from some kind of previous information it has found that this will maybe lead to this kind of an error here, then you could also maybe counteract. So would this be a good idea? Yeah, in this case, so if the robot is knowing to move away, whether it's a good idea to tell the robot maybe you shouldn't do this at all. Yeah? Of course, these two decisions can also contradict each other, but this is not really a problem. So what could happen, for example, is that maybe this term tells you shouldn't move away, and the other term tells you should move away. So in this case, of course, nothing changes, and if nothing changes anymore, then there's still the same error as it was before, but maybe because nothing changes, this becomes zero. So the dynamics of the system, so to say, helps us to decide which term we should listen to. There are some kind of strange cases which occur, and which we will analyze also later a little bit more in detail. But so this is a typical way. And of course, what you really should do is, of course, these two terms to provide some, to weight them with some quantities, which seem to be maybe like very delicately in their choice, but actually would turns out, or what can be proven, is that as soon as you have some kind of a reasonable range, this method actually is working. I hope I didn't mix up any of the large or great.
No, in the second if statement, when the error decreases.
This one or this one?
The second one, yes.
Huh?
Is the speed of the left wheel supposed to increase or decrease?
So if the error increases.
No, if it increases.
Here's the error. Of course. So I think this should be decreased down here. If the error increases, then you should already counteract. Even if maybe the error is actually negative. In this case, the first rule should tell you should decrease the speed. But if the robot is already moving away from the wall, then you should not really further decrease, but you should already start to decrease. So I'm sorry, here's definitely an error. So it was meant to be the same as here. So this second one should be a decrease. Please check yourself which one is a decrease. What often happens is, of course, you are dealing with small deviations only, so that this error of or difference of errors is actually a very small quantity. So maybe you do it quite often, so nothing really changes or not much changes. So this is a small quantity. So that's why often this quantity can be quite large here. On the other hand, you need to be careful because errors depend on a lot of noise, and if you take differences between noisy signals, you can get to a big mess, such that this quantity should be noisy, so you should not have k2, this weighting factor of the change of errors, too large. The other one should be maybe more of a normal size, so it depends a little bit how you measure your angles, how you measure your speeds. Because this was an x error and this was a speed error, so this kind of time step which connects the two ones will of course also determine k1. But on the other hand, it should be of a normal size. This can be larger, but it depends on the noise of the situation, whether it can really be chosen very large. So what we are doing here is already some kind of an control of the robot, which takes into account reactions of the robot itself. And I think we should maybe look at this a little bit more systematically or from a slightly higher level by considering this kind of control systems with various options. What we tell the robot or the control system is what we wanted to do in the end. And this system has a number of things to deal with. Of course, there is some kind of effect of the robot or of the system to the environment, which gives us some measurable output, which can or cannot be or may not be the same as the desired output. You may also have this ability to make some kind of predictions with a certain accuracy. Having all these options here, we should decide really how to tell the robot what we want. There are a number of different ways how to do this, and also a number of considerations we have to take. So what can of course happen, so even if the actual output is maybe identical to the desired output, this doesn't need to stay like this. There can be always lots of different perturbations in the systems. The robot, something can break, or something can come in the way, or some environmental changes, it can become cold or something like this, may just interfere with the actual output. On the other hand, of course, it might be also interesting to make use in some way of these predictions. And these different options are used by different control strategies in different ways. So what you usually hope is to get away with least effort. And if this doesn't work, then you need to add other mechanisms. But there are also typically other advantages and disadvantages. So one obvious way is to use in very straightforward and maybe like an imperative type of controls, this open loop control, where you, so if you have a desired output state or desired state simply of the system, you just calculate using an inverse model what needs to be done in order to make the robot arriving at this output state. Maybe not immediately, but at some point, the output of this inverse model will be able to move this to move to this one. So, for example, if you throw an object towards a goal, where you cannot really do much differently. So, once you have started the throwing act, then you cannot do anything about it. So, you need really to have some kind of computation or calculation that tell you what to, how to accelerate and when to release the object, and then maybe it will hit the goal or not. Yeah, so these are these kind of ballistic movements, and lots of our body movements we also do in this way. Yeah? We just start to move the arm up, and we actually do not really control much on the fly. Yeah? If we do more precise movements, then this wouldn't work. Then we take into account also information which becomes available. But so that's a very nice way to deal with a lot of control problems. You just know what to do and you go for it. Yeah? So it's kind of cheap, and it's often also very simple to implement. And it's very fast, yeah? Because as soon as you want something, it already is initiated. And if the robot is not too inert, then it will also happen quite quickly. But obviously the problem is that you need to know what needs to be done. So if I throw my stone and there's some kind of wind, or if the robot is starting and it has, for whatever temperature reason, a larger friction, and I didn't consider these kind of effects in my inverse model, then it's of course bound to fail. And what is even more critical, there is no way of for the robot to find out that it is going to fail. So if the model is unknown, it might not really be hopeless. So if I'm throwing my stones, I can just learn how to do it. Yeah, I just do it 100 times, and I consider or analyze the errors which I do. And so in this way, I also can improve. So for example, neural networks are used often in control in order just to deal with such situations here. On the other hand, so that's what we already said before. Yeah? So these disturbances are the main problem in such systems. They are essentially neglected, which in many cases can be okay, but in general, of course, it's not a good idea. And so as soon as you have some information about such disturbances, it is maybe possible to use a different type of control, what is usually called feed-forward control. This should not be mixed with this feed-forward model. So we are not talking about a model, which is still here in this case an inverse model. We're talking about control paradigms. And so the idea is, as soon as you have some kind of measurements of possible disturbances or some good expectations, then you can just take this into account to modify your motor command especially. So just think of an heating system, which also underlies a control mechanism. So you can maybe measure the temperature outside. This is not really what you control, so there's no hope really to influence the temperature outside. But this kind of information can tell you that you should maybe have more heating power if it's very cold outside in order to deal with it. So there is some kind of disturbances, some extra large deviation from the normal operating conditions. And by measuring these ones, you can, again, with this kind of inverse model, some kind of prior knowledge, what can be done for these disturbances, you can deal with it. Of course, yeah.
What part of the process do you generate the control signals for the goal output? Is it in the inverse model?
So the inverse model is transforming your desired state into an appropriate motor action. Yeah, so this is.
After you generated the control signals for your expected state, you may modify them according to your measurements.
Yes. So of course, I mean, here in the open loop, you also have disturbances because it's the real world, all kinds. But here in this way, you don't have any way of dealing with it. In the feed-forward model, You wanted to see this measurement error to enter in the inverse model. Yeah, maybe this would be more precise. But it depends a little bit how you do it. So if you have an inverse model which knows about all the measurements, where you can really precisely calculate both the desired and this environmental information. But often you have just a single guess and you do some kind of modulation of this kind of standard answer what to do. So you rule regulate it up or down a little bit independent on the measurement. So maybe you could, or maybe we should have another box here in between which deals with the tool. Yeah, but thank you for this comment. Anyway, so the idea is simply that the motor command is also influenced by additional information from the environment. So this can be often very effective or efficient. So for example, if an airplane is taking off, you know that the conditions are different than in mid-air or during landing. So if this anticipation is just given by the operation or by some other measurements or by predictors, that's a good idea to take this kind of precautious action, so to say, into account. But it still doesn't really tell us anything whether it's working itself. Yeah? So we measure something, we take some counteractions, and we don't really know whether these counteractions are as effective as we were hoping for. And for this purpose, we also have this kind of feedback control, which now not only measures something and makes some kind of bona fide changes of the motor commands, but which now really measures the output and changes the way how we want to react to the system. And this has lots of advantages. It does not only deal appropriately with any kind of disturbances, or with many kinds of disturbances, but it's also not really requiring this preciseness which was needed here. So here in this case, really need to know what to do. In this here, maybe even more, we need even to know how to vary the things to do. But here, it's much more easy. So this is the type of control which was suggested for this robot task. So you have this kind of K parameters there, but it's not really essential how to set it, because as soon as you continue to observe the system, you can always correct it. Of course, you can ask, is there some kind of optimal way to set it? And in control theory, you ask things like this for an airplane. This might be really important, not only just to be able to arrive at the goal state, but to do it maybe in a fast and energy efficient way, or in the most, in the optimal way in this respect. But for our application, any kind of reasonable reaction should be fine, and these feedback control strategies are able to deal with something like this. Of course, in practice, maybe you should be aware that each of these paradigms has its advantages or disadvantages. So we didn't mention the disadvantages of the feedback control system, which is obviously if you have to measure something before you can really react to it, and maybe there is some kind of delays involved in the motor command, or even more so in the environment, then this can take time, and it can we can just be too slow in order to react. And there's also this case that we are always lagging behind, and the system can the behavior of the system can be oscillatory in some cases. But if you combine it in a nice way, for example, if you have a forward model which tells us really what is going to happen, then we could even deal with these time delays in the feedback process. On the other hand, maybe it's also good to have some kind of an open loop model. If you have, for example, a robot arm, and if the forward model doesn't predict that you will soon impact in an obstacle, then for a robot arm, maybe it's enough to use an open loop model. So this kind of combinations is what you need to do in a more complex robot. For example, if you have seen this Asimo robot, the new version recently, you can guess that there is a very intricate combination of lots of these different control paradigms. For us, feedback control will be most interesting, and so this was also the start of control theory. We mentioned this last time, that there is some kind of continuous measurement of the speed here in this, or rotation speed in this case, and this is directly coupled back to the driving force for this rotation speed. In the same way, we can have an interpretation of a room heating as a feedback controller. So of course we could use also the temperature from the outside, which tells us maybe in the way of a feed forward model what to do. But we can also have a direct loop here, so there's a measurement inside the room, which switches simply on if the temperature becomes too low. So this can be either used in a direct way, this outside information, but sometimes it's also a good idea really to modify the type of control, so that maybe if it's very cold outside, we wanted this loop a little bit to be a little bit more sensitive. If it's anyway warm, we should not really switch it on too often and save maybe instead some energy. Of course, we will also have maybe some kind of open loop component, for example, a timer of the system would just be switching on and off according to the preset time and would not consider any other information in this case. So it might be still, of course, a problem how to set up these control loops, how it's possible to have some measurements which are also compatible here with our desired properties of the system, how to combine this in the control law, and we will go to through this in several steps. But there might be a number of different inputs and outputs. So for example, one important example is this what is called homeostatic control. So if you, for example, control the blood pressure or body temperature, there are really probably thousands or millions of different components, or at least thousands of muscles involved in regulating the size of the blood vessels and or the production of certain secrets from the or maybe you can change your transmissibility of the skin and things like this, or maybe you just take a clothes and you change your behavior. But it's a kind of very reliable result which you achieve in this way, that the temperature of at least the core or maybe the brain is really kept on a very precise level. And it's impressive that all these different informations are integrated in a apparently very reliable way. One question is, so if you have this feedback that's usually meant to to kill all the deviations from the desired state. So as soon as something deviates, it will be killed. So this would be this idea of negative feedback. So whatever happens will not is not supposed to happen again. But there's also this idea of positive feedback, which is used in some cases. So meaning that as soon as you have a slight deviation from an present state, you actually increase it. So what could be a role for such a positive feedback of a feedback loop? For a microphone, for example, this would not be really a good idea. But as soon as you can be sure that the system is not really producing overflow errors, but if there's some kind of maximal speed of a robot, even if the zero speed, for example, is unstable, the robot will not will just go to the maximal speed, which is maybe good enough. And so you could implement it this way, some kind of exploratory control. So as soon as the robot gets stuck, the speed of the robot becomes zero, then this kind of positive feedback loop would try to find a way to increase this zero speed, and so the robot would start to move again with this idea of self-excitation. So even if the robot has no plan, just the presence of positive feedback can make the robot freeing itself from any kind of traps or obstacles. Or there's, of course, lots of different applications in biological systems. So if you have to initiate certain movements, for example, in an insect walking, this was observed, then these ideas of that are used in controlling, for example, the legs of such a stick insect here. They are initiating themselves also by positive feedback. At some point, you are simply by the non-linearities in the systems or by some boundaries. You cannot go faster, but if something has stopped or if there's some kind of obstacles, then there will always be an activity in the system that continues the rhythmic movements of the 12 different joints. So just by this kind of self-excitation, the robot finds a way to move its legs and is not really requiring a central control telling each leg at each time step what to do. So this advantage that you can just makes things run is in a sense also valid if you have a negative feedback. So in spite of possible deviations, you can still be sure that the system is converging to its, or it's at least staying in the vicinity of the desired state. And you are able to achieve some kind of robustness, which is somehow impossible simply with simply considering forward or open loop control. There are, of course, a number of questions. If there is a chance of the system to start to oscillate, for example, how should we really set up this control? If there are delays in the system, how can we deal with this? Or so gain is usually just this kind of strength of effect of the feedback signal. So it can be positive or negative, but it can also be large or small. How can we find a good gain? So if we do not take the errors into account a lot, then it will take a long time before we react. If we do it too much, then of course it can become unstable. So this is what we will be discussing in the next lecture, and I hope to see you on next week again. Thank you.
final test group and they actually did the same science.
So we don't need to learn the test group.
I mean, I would suggest, if you have such a question, just make the size itself. So if you don't want to decide the test group at the same size, then that's perfect. If I didn't write that it will need to be of a different size, definitely a possible answer just to continue with it. Of course, you're asking probably because it could be, that it could be nice that it could be in any kind of complex room shapes and so on. But I'm not sure whether it is possible to deal with. So if you have time, just continue to generalize and so on. But if there is such a question, just be able to go to the
about the communication between the robots, mm-hmm. That says that there should be in the example some way of the robots knowing each other's estimated position, but I couldn't find that in the template. The template file is the one that's written back on the program.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing in there that should give another robot.
Okay, so what kind of robot is this? So what you do is your supervisor, no?
Yeah.
And the supervisor can do the communication. So I think about the different points that you don't have to provide. This is how you do this successfully. So maybe sometimes you're not doing it.
Right. Because it sounded like in the touch, it sounds like
already there. Yeah, I think maybe I could explain to you.
In terms of teaming up with the obstacles,
without moving everything around. I said if you could not do this. I mean, at home you could do this, but in the park, if I say you don't, you are not required to do it. You can do it. I may even give you some extra points if you do it, but it is you can do it. Of course, yeah. I know. Maybe we just meet outside again.
About one of them. One of the replies to the question inventions to use distance sensors. And I believe they are not provided with the sample code, right? I mean, they are only two.